The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Somebody asked me recently if I would talk about karma at some point. And since I'm getting ready to go away, I thought I would talk about karma tonight. So this is a big topic, so we'll see what we can cover in terms of the topic. So as we live our lives, you know, we all notice, I think, that there are ways that we struggle, ways that we suffer. And a lot of this struggling and suffering comes out of reactivity. That we see things happening and we don't like them. And so we want to fix them or change them. Or there are things that we want to have and we make the effort to try to keep them and hold on to them. So there's this kind of way that we engage with our world, which is kind of out of this almost automatic get rid of things we don't like, hold on to things we like. And this process is one of the ways that we really actually end up in suffering. Because by definition, if we're trying to change the way things are, we're not happy with the way things are. So it may not be a massive kind of suffering. I mean, that term suffering often, maybe it seems a little too grand or something. I don't know. But we do experience a sense of dissatisfaction. The term that is translated as suffering from the Pali, from the Buddha's language, is dukkha. And it actually has a much broader meaning than just suffering. It means dissatisfaction. It means stress. It means unease. So it really does incorporate a wide range of experiences. And we all experience this at some point or other in our lives. Every day we experience some kind of sense of things just aren't quite right. And the reason for that, a lot of the reason for that is that we're reacting to things, that we want things to be other than they are. And often it feels like we're responding and reacting to the environment, to our friends, to the situations. And it's almost as if we don't have a lot of say in how we react, that it feels almost hardwired or very programmed, at least, very strong habits and patterns that we have, each of us has, in the way of responding and reacting to the world that creates our sense of dissatisfaction. But sometimes it feels like this reactivity is out of our conscious control. And it's not something that we really can get a handle on. And this actually, this feeling of things being out of our control, I mean, there's not only the reactivity to wanting things to be different, but we see that this reactivity itself is unpleasant and a source of our suffering. You know, we get angry at somebody and we see, well, we don't really want to be angry, but we don't seem to have much control over that. And so we suffer because we feel like we should have control when we don't have control. So why do we suffer? These habits and patterns of ways that we have behaved for a long time. And they're so ingrained that it is that they are almost below our level of conscious ability to connect with them. At least for most of us, much of our ways that we react and respond, all these habits and patterns, are kind of below the level of what we have conscious access to. And so we suffer. So the Buddha's answer to why we suffer too has a lot to do with this kind of under the radar, so to speak, habits and patterns that essentially choices that are made out of conditioning, choices that are made out of habits and patterns that we've built up over the years of our lives. We don't want to be reactive to things, but we've been reactive for so long that it's almost like we don't have control over that. And so these choices that we're making, or choices that are being made by habits and patterns. And the explanation for why we suffer from the Buddha's perspective is explained essentially in his teaching on karma. So what is karma actually? There's some, the term is used in everyday language a lot, and so we kind of think we know what it means. But I think actually some of the ways in which we use that term in common speech, it's not exactly what is meant by karma in the Buddhist teaching. So I want to describe a little bit about what actually karma means from the perspective of the Buddhist teachings. The Buddha described the term karma, which is the Sanskrit term, and kama is the Pali term. I'll probably use them both in this talk. I am familiar with using the Pali a lot, and so I'll probably slip into that, but I'm trying to use the one that's more familiar to us, which is karma. The term karma or kama is literally means something like action or work. And the Buddha's teaching on karma is in particular around intentional action. So the teaching on karma is a teaching around intention and action. And it's very strongly connected to a teaching on cause and effect. So this teaching on karma is understood in, when the Buddha talked about it, he talked about it not as something that is a good idea to believe in, but rather as a natural law. That is just something ingrained in the fabric of the universe and humanity. That it's just it's a natural law. And so what he is saying that he's describing is just a natural law, much the way gravity is a natural law. That whether or not somebody describes gravity, gravity functions. You hold something up and let it go and it drops. The law of gravity at work. It doesn't matter whether somebody has said, this is the law of gravity, that is the way things behave. And it's likewise with this, the law of karma. It's a description, the Buddha says that it is a description of a certain way that our the workings of our minds, how our minds work. So, you know, we can think about this just as a natural extension, in a way, of the way the universe works. I mean, the universe is governed by laws. There are laws of the environment. There's laws about how genetics work. You know, you plant an apple tree and an apple tree grows. There's laws about how the weather works. I mean, there's laws of physics. So all of these kind of natural laws that don't necessarily have much to do with how our minds work, but just that the universe kind of runs in a lawful way. There's laws also of the workings of our mind that are a little different than the workings of karma. There's just the kind of fact of sense impression, and you know that sense object meets the eye and it produces a vision and we see something and we recognize it. That kind of thing is also a kind of a natural process that goes on. And then there is the law of human behavior, of how we relate to our world and what the consequences are of that relationship. So essentially, in simplest terms, the law of karma is actions have consequences. Some kind of common aphorisms that reflect this. We reap what we sow. What goes around comes around. Those are kind of reflections of this law of karma that people kind of know just by living in the world. So a definition, this is kind of, I think this is a paraphrase of Bhikkhu Bodhi, is a description of the law of karma. And this sounds like a technical description, but I'll unpack it for you. The law of karma is the capacity of our intentional actions to produce a morally or ethically appropriate result. So what does that mean? So first there's this notion of intentional action. So the first thing that I want to talk about a little bit is intention. Every single action that we make, whether it's an action of body, an action of speech, or an action in our minds, getting ready to think or experience some kind of an emotion, every single action that we engage in has an intention behind it. So before we move, there's an intention to move. Before we think, there's an intention to think. Before we speak, there's an intention to speak. Whether or not we are consciously aware of that intention. And that is crucial, because I think often when we use the word intentional, we use the word intention, we mean something that we're conscious of. Something that we, like we say, I intended to do this. Or I didn't intend to do that, it just happened. We're thinking, well, you know, I didn't choose that. But a choice was made. So if you are engaging with somebody and you know, oh, I shouldn't do something, but then suddenly you blirt something out, it's like, well, I didn't mean to do that. You know, so that we might say, well, that wasn't intentional. But from this perspective that we're talking about now, there is an intention underneath that was motivated by some habit or pattern. So every action that we take has this intention behind it. It's an impulse that motivates us. It's kind of the link between the mind and behavior. So that we're not going to do something unless there's that mental impulse behind it. If there were no mental impulse to move, movement wouldn't happen. Unless it's gravity. You know, if you die and you're sitting up when you die, you're going to, you know, fall forward. And that's not intention that's creating that movement. That's the law of gravity that's creating that movement. So that's a kind of a distinction between, some action that might be generated not out of intention. But the vast majority of our behavior, it has a intention behind it. This intention is, in and of itself, it's neutral. It's ethically neutral. That any behavior has just got this kind of energetic impulse behind it. It's that moment where we can know before something happens that it's about to happen. And we can actually see this as we bring mindfulness to our experience. We can start to see that we know we're going to move before we move. And sitting in sitting meditation, you might be sitting there and then you notice that your nose itches. And you might notice that you're going to lift your arm and scratch the itch before it happens. That's noticing the intention. Noticing that impulse of something, that you're about to do something. So this energetic impulse moves our behavior. It's a mental event that moves our behavior. So kind of, I'm going to give an analogy here, and I'll use this analogy, I think, throughout the talk. If you have a soccer ball and you kick the soccer ball, the energetic movement of your leg, the swinging of your leg, has some energy in it, and it gets transferred to the soccer ball. And that's kind of how intention works, that there's this energetic impulse and it motivates something to happen. Like when you swing your leg and kick the soccer ball moves. So you've got the cause of that impulse, that swing, and then that impulse gets translated into the movement, the result of the soccer ball moving. So our intentions move us in a direction. The direction that we end up moving, you know, if you have a soccer ball, you can kick it from one side and the soccer ball will go that way. If you kick it from the other side, the soccer ball will go that way. And so there's a directionality in that example of the soccer ball, that you can kind of move the ball in a particular direction based on where you kick it from. And likewise in our minds, the directionality of our intentions is defined by what motivates those intentions. So every intention, so the intention itself is neutral. Accompanying that intention is a motivation why that intention is being put into place. So you're getting ready to say something to somebody. There's just that energetic impulse to speak, and there's a reason why you're getting ready to speak. You're getting ready to speak because you want to convey some information, or you're getting ready to speak because you're a little ticked off and you want to say something in response, or you're getting ready to speak because there's a sense of wanting to connect or help somebody. So there's all kinds of reasons why we do things. So really it is not just the intention, but the intention and the motivation together. Because the intention itself is neutral. The motivation is what gives the spin to our actions. That spin, that intention, that motivation, can be either skillful or unskillful. If it's unskillful, generally it's motivated out of greed, aversion, or delusion. It's motivated out of some of these deeper habits of wanting to hold on to things that are pleasant, wanting to get rid of things that are unpleasant, spacing out about things that we don't particularly care about or notice, not connecting with things. Those motivations, if we're acting out of unskillful motivations, if we're acting out of greed or aversion or delusion, basically what the teaching on karma says is that those actions will tend to lead us in the direction of suffering. If we're acting out of skillful motivations, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, or to put it more positively, non-greed out of generosity, non-aversion out of kindness and compassion, non-delusion out of wisdom, out of clarity. So if we're motivated out of wisdom, clarity, compassion, kindness, generosity, that tends to move us towards happiness. So essentially, you know, the definitions of skillful and unskillful are those things that are unskillful are those things that move us towards suffering. Those things that are skillful are those things that move us towards happiness. So essentially, the definitions of skillful and unskillful come out of this natural law that when we behave in ways that are motivated out of greed, aversion, or delusion, we tend to suffer. And this, again, the Buddha talks about this as a natural law. It's not something that he says is a good idea to just believe. He said, no, this is just what's happening. This is just what's happening. Whether you believe it or not, it is happening. It's like the law of gravity, which is just happening. And so essentially, the definition of skillful and unskillful, the definition of what takes us to happiness or takes us to suffering, comes out of this natural law. So the teaching on karma, the capacity of our intentional actions to produce a morally or ethically appropriate result. And so the intentional actions, being motivated out of greed, aversion, or delusion, produce a result that leads us towards suffering. The actions out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion lead us towards happiness. So now I need to talk a little bit about the distinction between karma and the result. As I talked a little bit about the result here, the karma itself is that the movement, the direction of the impulse. So the intention combined with its motivation. Those are the karma. That is our karma. The result of karma is the effect that happens as a result of that those motivations. So essentially we can think of the karma as being the cause and the result as being the effect. It's kind of like, again, kicking that soccer ball. If you're kicking it from this side, from the right-hand side, it tends to go to the left. So the karma in this case, to make this analogy, the karma is the moving of the leg kicking from the right-hand side. The result or the effect is that the ball moves to the left. So the karma itself is the intention combined with the motivation. And that's a little different from how we typically talk about karma in at least the way I mostly hear people using the word karma in kind of everyday conversation. They say, oh, that happened to you, well, that's just your karma. They're talking about the result. They're using karma to mean the result of karma as opposed to that intentionality. So with the result. So we often think in terms of cause and effect as something that happens, you know, a cause and then there's an immediate effect. With karma, the effect or the result may or may not be immediate. It may not happen right away. You know, and this is where the soccer ball analogy breaks down because, you know, you move the leg to kick the ball and the ball moves immediately. So that's, you know, that's an immediate result. With karma, with the way that we engage in our lives, certain things that we do may not produce an immediate result. It's kind of like the karma is a seed that is planted. Karma is very often talked about as being a seed, as it is kind of like the potential for something. The definition that I mentioned, the capacity or the potential of our intentional actions to produce a morally, ethically appropriate result. So a seed represents potential. You plant the seed in the ground, and it takes causes and conditions to come together for that seed to produce the plant. And it takes time for that seed to produce that plant. That seed might actually sit in the ground for months before enough water comes along to moisturize it and create the sprout. It's kind of similar with karma. We plant these seeds based on the way that we behave. If we are engaging in actions of greed, a lot of greed, we're planting a lot of seeds of greed. And when the conditions are ripe, those seeds will sprout. So just a simple example here. Suppose you tell a lie to somebody. Now, immediately, the impact of that telling a lie, I can envision a couple different ways that it might impact you. If you tell a lie to somebody, you might have an immediate impact of feeling some agitation or worry. You know, is that person going to find out I told this lie? So there might just be this immediate kind of agitation as a result of that lie. Or perhaps there might be a sense of relief. It's like, oh, okay, good. I don't have to deal with that person. That's over. I can just let that go. So the immediate kind of result may be widely varied depending on what's going on for you. And say, suppose, and this is, again, this is just an example, but suppose that, say, 4 or 5 months later, that person finds out that you lied to them. There may, at that point, then be consequences, painful consequences that come up. So the seed was planted, and then the conditions came together years later or months later for some of that, the results from that intention to manifest. So when the karma comes into its result, and often this is spoken about in the suttas as the karma ripens. When the karma ripens, the result is felt by us as some happiness or painfulness, depending on the seeds that were planted. If the seeds of greed, aversion, delusion were planted, there will be some kind of painfulness that results from those seeds. The seeds of generosity, kindness, compassion, wisdom, clarity were planted, there will be some kind of happiness that results from those seeds. The results of karma. So I've been talking some about the results here, the ripening of karma. The results are not deterministic. This is a way in which people sometimes misunderstand this teaching of karma. And in fact, this is a way in which the Buddhist teachings diverged from many of the teachers of his day. That there was a contingent of teachers in his time that felt like if you behave in this way, these are the consequences. So the teaching on karma is a teaching on cause and effect. So skillful action tends towards happiness. Unskillful action tends towards suffering. Rather than it being a kind of deterministic thing, that if you do this thing, then you will, for instance, you know, if you are a murderer, if you are a murderer, you'll go to hell. That kind of simplistic notion, that if you have murdered somebody, your experience, you will go to hell. That's kind of one way that the deterministic teachings are taught, that kind of thing. So kind of that simple. Certain action leads to certain result. And the Buddha said, actually, karma is much more fluid than that. It depends on way more kind of the web of causes and conditions that come together is vast. It's kind of a network of vast causes and conditions that come together. And the karma that happens in a moment, the intention and the motivation that happen in a moment, are arising in a field of experience, of conditions, and that field will greatly impact how that karma is experienced, what the result of that karma is. So there's many conditions in the world, and many conditions actually in our minds that impact that tendency towards suffering or happiness. So here's something that the Buddha said. He said, for anyone who says, in whatever way a person makes karma, that is how it is experienced, so essentially in that deterministic way, somebody does this, then you will have this result. There is no living of the holy life. There is no opportunity for the right ending of stress, of suffering. But for anyone who says, when a person makes karma to be felt in such and such a way, that is how the result is experienced, there is the living of the holy life, and there is the opportunity for the right ending of suffering. So what that means, when a person makes karma to be felt in such and such a way, that is, essentially it's saying that when we act out of greed, aversion, or delusion, we will tend to experience unpleasantness. There will be some unpleasantness that results from that. The degree of that unpleasantness may vary widely. Likewise, with skillful action, if we make actions out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that will result in some pleasant or happy experience, the degree of which may vary widely. So further in this teaching, he says, there is the case where a trifling evil deed done by a certain individual takes him to hell. There is the case where the very same sort of trifling evil deed done by another individual is experienced in the here and now, and for the most part barely appears for a moment. So this is really pointing to the conditions. He says that the reason for this has to do with the climate in which that action happens. So if we keep going with the soccer ball analogy, it's as if in kicking that soccer ball, there's a strong wind blowing. And so if the wind is blowing in this direction and you're trying to kick the soccer ball in that direction, it's going to tend to go in that direction, but then it's going to get carried with the wind. Or if the wind is blowing in the same direction in which you're kicking the soccer ball, if you kick it in that way, it's going to get amplified. It's going to go even further. So the wind in this example is kind of like the climate of our minds. If we have cultivated a lot of unskillful actions in our lives, if we've lived in a way that has not been so wholesome, then our unskillful actions have stronger consequences in a way. But if we do that same unskillful action, but we had been generally engaged in wholesome actions of being kind, of compassionate, of not harming, of engaging in non-harming, engaging ethically in the world, then it's as if we're kind of kicking that ball into the wind, and it mitigates that, the result of that action. Does this make sense? Are you understanding this? So the mental climate in which an action is made impacts the result. So this is not a deterministic teaching. It's not a hard and fast thing. The Buddha gives another analogy here. He says, suppose a man were to drop a salt crystal into a small amount of water in a cup. Would that water become salty and become unfit to drink? Yes. Is this a small amount of water and you're putting a relatively good-sized chunk of salt in it? Then he goes on to say, if you take that same salt crystal and drop it into a river, and then take a glass of that river water, you're not going to taste the salt. The salt is there. It is there, but it is just diluted by the size of the river. So there's another aspect around this, the teaching on karma, that not only does the climate of our mind impact how karma unfolds, so our intentional actions are mitigated by the kind of climate in which the action occurs, so the way that we are kind of, whether we have generally engaged in wholesome or unwholesome behavior, the actions that we choose to do now, if we engage and try to act skillfully, act in wholesome ways, that can radically, radically alter the tendencies if we have been behaving in very unskillful ways. So that climate of our mind can be radically altered by choosing in this moment to begin to act skillfully. There's a story in the suttas about this. And I love this story because it really speaks to me about this possibility of transforming ourselves. It's the story of a mass murderer. In the time of the Buddha, there was a man named Angulimala. And he was named Angulimala. Angulimala, basically, a mala means garland or necklace. And Anguli means finger. And he was a mass murderer, and he was chopping off the finger, I think the little finger of each of his victims, and stringing it onto a garland that he wore around his neck. So Angulimala means finger garland, which is what he was doing. So he killed many, many people. The story says he killed 999 people. And he was greatly feared. The king at the time was trying to find ways to catch him. It seemed as though he was unstoppable. Anybody who would go in to try to stop him ended up getting killed. And the Buddha found out about him somehow, and the story goes that he kind of surveyed Angulimala's mind with his own mind through psychic powers of mind reading. And he discovered, through looking at Angulimala's mind, that he actually had the capacity to become free from suffering, to wake up, to become completely purified, to really radically let go of this path that he was on and shift towards a path of purity and freedom. And so he put himself in Angulimala's path. And the story goes that Angulimala, seeing the Buddha, thought, oh, this person, this will be an easy, my, you know, I, his, he had been, he had set out to get 1,000 fingers. So he thought, this is my last one, this will be easy. And the Buddha, through his psychic powers, did something that made it appear as though the Buddha was walking very slowly. And no matter how fast Angulimala ran to try to catch him, he couldn't catch him. And he got so frustrated, he yelled out to the Buddha, "Stop! Stop!" And the Buddha said to him, "I have stopped. You haven't stopped. You need to stop." And this somehow turned Angulimala's mind. And to make a very long story short, I don't have time to go to the whole story, but to make a very long story short, he decided to become a monk under the Buddha. He practiced meditation and became completely enlightened. Let go completely of his unskillful actions. Now, I can only imagine what it must have been like for him to sit in meditation and remember his actions. It must have been extremely painful to do that. That kind of purification, very painful purification. That is some of the results of his karma. That mental pain and suffering of sitting through the memories, the reliving of those murders, and realizing how much harm he had caused. That was some of the results of that karma. And then it was said, after he became fully awakened, he would go out for alms round, and the people in the villages wouldn't give him any food, because they remembered him as being a mass murderer, and they didn't want to support him. But he was ordained as a monk, and so they didn't particularly want to, you know, kill him or anything, but they would, like, throw rocks at him, and, you know, he'd come back with nicks and cuts and bruises and things like that after going on alms round. And the Buddha said to him, "Bear it. You are suffering here and now in a minor way for that which you might have burned in hell for thousands of years." So to me, this teaching really points to the fact that even with massive, unwholesome tendencies, we can turn the battleship with bringing our attention to our experience. It takes strong mindfulness, it takes courage, it takes dedicated attention, and it really is mindfulness that is the key. This teaching of Angulimala, I think, really points us to the present moment. It is through the present moment that we can transform our karma. We can transform our choices. The only place we can choose is now. We cannot change our choices from the past. They have been set in place. They have been set in motion. But choosing now how we respond to our situation, given the choices from the past, choosing skillfully now begins to turn our minds towards happiness. It may be a slow turning, but the understanding of this teaching of karma is it does turn us towards happiness. So mindfulness, really the power here is mindfulness. Mindfulness gives us the ability to start to see these choices. These choices I talked about at the beginning as kind of being under the radar. These choices that come out of habits and patterns where we feel like we can't see them, we can't control them. Mindfulness begins to, I think of it as kind of lowering the horizon of the subconscious. In my own experience, I have seen that the choices that we make, this kind of what seem to be subconscious choices coming out of habitual patterns, they can be seen. As mindfulness gets stronger, and it is mindfulness that does this work, it's beginning to be able to be continuous with our mindfulness, to just notice moment by moment what is happening. As we get more continuous with mindfulness, these more subtle choices start to be revealed to us. And as those choices are revealed, as they become apparent to us, we begin to have a choice. When we see that there's a choice being made, we have the opportunity to... There's a place where we can decide. Because in that moment of intention, the action has not yet happened. So in seeing an intention arise, in seeing a motivation arising with it, we begin to have a little bit of say, do I follow through on that? Do I let it go? It's a slow process. It's a slow process. And some of what we get to do is see our choices, see an unskillful motivation, and see that the momentum of that is strong. And we get to see that the choice was made, and then we get to experience the consequences of that choice. And this is not a mistake. This is actually how the mind begins to understand. It's the part of the way that the training works. That as we see the choices that are made and understand how choices are made, and we understand the results of those choices, the mind itself, in a very natural way. Again, this is a natural law in a way. To me, it feels like some way in which our minds and bodies are put together. That when the mind begins to understand that its choices out of habits and patterns are leading us to suffering, it begins to let go of those choices. Because ultimately, our minds and bodies don't want to suffer. So when we see how suffering is constructed, actually constructed, it begins to dismantle itself. It sounds kind of magical, but it's actually it's like a natural law in a way. The reason why it doesn't happen automatically is because we have a fundamental misunderstanding about what happiness is. We think happiness is getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want. And in a moment, we feel a little bit of relief from that movement. We feel a small amount of relief when we get something that we want or get rid of something we don't want. Oh, phew, I figured it out. For this moment, I have some control. I figured this out. And that feels good. There's a sense of control there. And yet what we haven't seen is all of the momentum of greed and aversion underneath. And we aren't really getting to see the ultimate consequences of those choices. And so as mindfulness begins to reveal the choices and the consequences, the practice does its work on us. Ooh, I'd hope to have some time for questions, but no. So that's the fundamental teaching around karma, what I have said. One of the main areas in which people get confused around this teaching on karma is because often the teaching on karma is connected with the teaching on rebirth. That, you know, there's this notion of past lives coming and influencing what's happening to us now. And that's how the people talk about the teaching of karma. They think about karma means that things I did in my past life are impacting me now. The understanding of it is basically what I've described around choices that we make, choices that are made, the intention and the motivation that come together in the moment, that process is what is understood to be the kind of arc of the law of karma. And with respect to rebirth, the understanding is simply that that process is more than just fitting into this single life. That the we think about karma as kind of a flow of energy. That there may be a flow of energy that comes from a previous life into this life. Now, I don't know about this. I don't have any evidence in my own experience for rebirth. And for me, the issue around karma with respect to the teaching of rebirth is a little bit of a red herring. It's not that important to me. Because I have clearly seen in this life, moment to moment, how this teaching unfolds. It really is very clear to me that when I behave skillfully, my life moves in the direction of more happiness, of more peacefulness. It's very clear to me that that this teaching of looking at my choices that I'm making and the motivation behind them in this moment is what is making me more happy in my life. That is what I care about with respect to this teaching. Whether or not the stream of conditions comes from the beginning of my birth or comes from thousands of lives before is less relevant. The way to engage with this teaching is in this moment. Can you meet this moment with a skillful choice? That's the only place we have any control in any case. It's not even really control. It's more of a... there is some choice that can be made in this moment. And this is the only moment that we can do that. So this is the place to engage, here and now. And whether or not it continues in future lives, I don't know. If it does, I'm on a path that looks like it would be helpful. If it doesn't, I'm happier in this life. So to me, it feels like engaging with this teaching, it's not so necessary, at least for me, to really have the sense of belief in previous lives. So if I had more time, I would talk more about that, but it's time to stop, so. Sorry I didn't have time for questions. And I'll see you in a couple of months. Thank you.